Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. That was Creedence Clearwater, and I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can get sign up for podcasts there, or look at archives of our show on our blog. You can also check out our videos on YouTube. And with me right now is our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We'll be joined shortly by DJ extraordinaire Jeep Ward, who's sitting in as a guest co-host. And we will be talking today about war. But before we get into the subject, I want to mention that on September 10th, that's our next show, because it's the second Monday in September, we're going to deal with the Oklahoma City bombing. Remember that? April 19th, 1995, there were 168 people killed in an explosion in the federal building in Oklahoma City. And we're going to have on as our guest director James Lowe, who's just made a movie called A Noble Lie, and he's going to raise the question about whether the government has told the truth about Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bombing. Was it possibly some kind of false flag operation? Of course, this is going to be the day before the commemoration of the anniversary of the terrorist attack of 9/11, so we'll also be talking about that. So be sure to join us on September 10th. At noon, Monday, September 10th at noon, for our discussion of the Oklahoma City bombing and our guest director, James Lane. And since this is the last Monday of the month, we devote the entire program to our monthly war report, in which we review recent developments in the global war. And with our military affairs commentator, Marchand, we explain their larger strategic significance. And to my knowledge, In Context War Report is the only show of its kind on radio or TV. And we are very grateful to you guys out there, you listeners, for your generous donations to WPKN, which make this show possible. And where I understand our next fundraiser is going to be in October, tentatively. And we will really appreciate it when that happens, if you guys go to your phones and join in the effort to keep the station healthy and on the air. And of course, in the meantime, if the spirit moves you, and we hope it does, you can always go to WPKN.org and make a tax-deductible donation to keep this listener-sponsored non-commercial station on the air. So, Marchand, let's start with Syria. As we've been discussing for over a year now on In Context, the conflict in Syria is really part of a struggle between the great powers for control of the oil-rich Mideast. A little different picture from what we seem to be getting on the corporate media. And what really seems to be happening is that on one side, you have the U.S., NATO, and their regional allies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And on the other side, you have Russia, China, and their regional allies, which include Syria and Iran. So in the recent terms of recent developments, could you talk about the very recent report that U.S. reconnaissance teams are on the ground in Syria preparing for a landing of U.S., French, and British special forces, ostensibly to seize Syria's chemical and biological weapons?
Well, I think that I think it's very interesting that now we're saying, well, we suddenly are planning on putting special forces, basically commandos, on the ground in Syria, and that, you know, we're planning on taking Assad's chemical weapons and all the rest of it. When who do you think's been training these Syrian rebels this entire time? The only difference now is that we're acknowledging it. We have had black ops. You know, this is what the U.S. Army Special Forces, the Green Berets, as they're known in sort of the Hollywood setting. The Green Berets, this is what they specialize in, going behind enemy lines, training insurgents to fight against the whatever party we don't like. So the Syrian, I'm sure these guys have been boots on the ground in Syria, in Iran, in places all over the world for very long periods of time. The only difference is we're acknowledging it now.
It wasn't until just last week that President Obama said that he warned Syria that it would face, this is in the New York Times, that it would face American military intervention if there were signs that its arsenal of unconventional weapons were being moved. And it was the first direct threat that Obama's made against Syria. Although, as you say, behind the scenes and through our surrogates, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, we've been actively involved.
Well, that's just it. Only now are we starting to acknowledge it. The reason why we're starting to acknowledge is we're trying to send a message to the Russians, because the Russians and the Chinese have sent a message to us. The Russians have deployed 15,000 troops, and missile systems to Syria, and they have roughly 50,000 some odd troops in Iran. So we're trying to say to them that, oh, we can play your game. You know, you want to play tough with us? Well, we'll play tough. We'll invade, and we'll, you know, that's why we're acknowledging it. It's more of a message to, because the Syrians know we're there already.
Right.
It's a message to the Russians,
and they've been aware of this. That folks, we could just fall back and trace the evolution of this involvement. It starts in Bush Jr. administration, when he was started funding millions of dollars to fund opposition anti-government groups in Syria. And then it was kicked up a big step when Obama appointed Robert Ford as the ambassador, I believe it was around January of 2010. And Ford is an interesting character because he's a protege of John Negroponte. And John Negroponte was the top diplomat in Central America at the time we organized this really a terrorist war in Nicaragua, which killed thousands of people, and we financed these mercenaries to do the killing there. Negroponte was involved there, and Negroponte again was involved as ambassador to Iraq at a time when there were death squads roaming the streets there, killing Sunni. So this guy Ford comes in, he immediately starts meeting with opposition groups, and the Syrian people, if you remember the press, they were attacking him, they besieged his car, they tried to prevent him going to the meetings, because they knew what he was up to. And just a few months later, the violence, I think it was around April.
And there's nothing new in history either. I mean, you know, we funded the Contras against the Sandinistas, we funded rebels to overthrow Mossadegh, the democratically elected leader of Iran, Operation Gladio, we actually funded the Red Brigades to kidnap and kill the Italian prime minister. So, I mean, this is people who say that, oh, you know, it couldn't be that we are sponsoring these people. We've done this before. It's part of the game we play. The Russians do the same thing. The Russians funded the Sandinistas.
Right.
We funded the Contras.
Right.
And, you know, to be honest, we don't really care who gets hurt in the middle, because our goal, our objective, ultimately, one of the things that people have to stop being simpletons, they have to realize that we're not really concerned with democracy. What we're concerned with is pushing the Russians out of whether it's South America or the Middle East, because the primary concern here is that the Russians will have full spectrum dominance over the world's natural resources. Now, there's also a basis for this too. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, I keep getting confused whether he's president or prime minister, because he's always switching up
and fights
with the constitution.
He's in charge, yeah.
He's the new czar. He's going to be the new Caesar. But he said in his own manifesto that if Russia can control the world's access to natural resources, Russia can, by extension, control the world. It can be the world's greatest empire. They don't need to have, you know, 100,000 troops in New York City when, if they have full spectrum dominance over the Middle East, they force us out of the Middle East, Siberia has the world's largest oil supply, then they control Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, and they have control over the Mediterranean, which has all those natural gas resources. They would control all of the natural gas and oil going into Europe. They already control almost all the natural gas and oil going into Germany.
That's Poland, right. And Eastern Europe.
That's
right. Europeans are very dependent now on the Russians.
Which also raises another question, too, and I'll get to that in a second. But then they gain full-spectrum dominance over the oil resource in South America. It doesn't matter how militarily advanced we are. It doesn't matter that we have a huge landmass. They can turn off the lights, and they can do the same thing to the Europeans. We always think that, well, if we get into it with the Russians, the Europeans will come back us up. And I was looking at this yesterday. Europe's dependency on Russian oil and natural gas, all the Russians have to do is turn off the pipeline, because it all comes from Russian-owned Caspian Sea. In fact, all of the pipelines going to Europe are owned by Gazprom, which is the Russian state oil company, which happens to also own soccer teams and all the news agencies. It's Putin's private, well, it's Putin's private company.
It's state-owned. Actually, took it back from the oligarchs, right?
Exactly. When he imprisoned them all and had many of them disappeared.
Because he's basically, as I see him, he's a czar. He's a nationalist. He's looking out for the long-term welfare, the reestablishment of the Russian Empire. So we have to see these events not as disjointed ad hoc movements as our corporate media often portrays, whether it's the invasion of Lebanon or Libya or the takeover of Syria, but as part of coherent plans by both sides, by the Russians, say, on the Chinese on their side, and by the U.S. and NATO on the other side.
Exactly. What we're in right now, these aren't a bunch of, you know, disjointed, oh, you know, you got excuse me, sorry, gassy. You got a bunch of, you know, it's not a bunch of disjointed, you know, revolutionaries here, revolutionaries there, who all want democracy. What it is we are fighting a war against the Russians right now. And right now it's covert. But we know if we can push the Russians out of the Middle East, we control that huge chunk of oil and natural gas, which means that it means our energy independence. It means our energy independence, and it also means the independence of our energy independence of our allies. What we're terrified of, what our leadership is terrified of, and of course they're having trouble. They can't really sell this to the American people. But if we allow the Russians to have full spectrum dominance over the Middle East and South America and the Mediterranean, that means the United States as a nation will be entirely dependent on the Russians. It's never been like this for us. This would literally be like a blockade. If the Russians so chose, they could shut off the lights, pretty much shut off the power and the flow of oil and natural gas into the United States, and we would end up having to comply with whatever their foreign policy decisions were. We would have to comply with whatever their trade advantages they wanted. I mean, it would be obscene. And that's what the leadership in this country is really afraid of. But of course, they can't sell the American people on the idea of, you know, going out and trying to control the oil supply in the Middle East. And so it has to be for democracy.
And we've just been joined by DJ extraordinaire Jeep Ward. It's good to have you with us today.
Hey, what's going on?
We've been very happy to have Jeep with us during the summer. As Gus Cadavero has been away, and it's been great to have you. Thanks for joining us again,
I feel like
Jeep.
It's a summer internship.
That's right. Well, we've been talking about the geopolitical situation as it relates to U.S. and NATO versus Russia, China, each with their regional allies lined up.
I was actually just mentioning it because I was listening on the way in. Sorry, I got stuck in traffic.
But Syria is key because if Syria falls, Russians get Iran, and Iran with Russia are they like tied for number one in energy between the oil and the natural gas. And boy, if they control, and then Saudi Arabia is vulnerable because it's really unstable, you know, and they have vulnerable.
All it would take, I mean, Saudi Arabia from a strategic standpoint is the most undefensible bit of desert on the planet. I mean, it would not take much. All of the oil resources are in the eastern province of Qatif, which is on the side with Iran. So all it would take is Iran to land a small force of Marines or commandos, and they gain full spectrum dominance over the oil resources. And they could let the Saudis have the rest of the bits of sand and whatnot.
That's right.
But they would control the oil.
The desert. Let me ask you this.
With that, you're controlling all types of transportation throughout the world. And
Jeep, you can see that they're building the case here. It's going to be about chemical weapons. Their backup plan is it's humanitarian intervention, right? Yeah. That's because USAID just announced that they're like 2.5 million
people. It's interesting that you should mention that because Debka File has a article just put up today. Says Al-Qaeda targets Riyadh, Jeddah, and Sderot, which is in Israel. Saudi cell had chemical weapons. They just captured a Saudi terrorist cell, an Al-Qaeda terrorist cell, with chemical weapons.
Okay,
so where do you think they're going to link those chemical weapons to?
So let me ask you, Jeep, do you think the American people are going to buy this? If we land, will we land special forces? Is that going to fly?
I think the American people are going to buy whatever they want us to buy because it's for our safety.
You're right.
You know? I was mentioning that it's like all of a sudden is the 80s again. You know, we're super concerned with Russia, you know, and the communist threat of China. It's like, what happened?
Yeah, I think
you know,
that,
like
yeah,
I thought we were moving beyond this.
Well, you know,
but we need to have a set enemy. You know,
exactly.
we are against this red menace of communism.
What happened the day that the Soviet Union collapsed? Bush Sr. began the great war for global hegemony. I mean, he didn't, you know, he could have taken advantage of it. Okay, they're done. We can have world peace now. No, the next thing he did was invade the Persian Gulf.
And really, what he could have done to prevent, you know, future Russian animosity towards the Americans would have been to come in and say, okay, you know, the Soviet Union's collapsed, but, you know, we're going to help with humanitarian aid so you don't starve. Instead, we basically went, you guys are, you know, you're
yours. Glad your empire fell, jerks.
Exactly.
Talk about how PO'd the Russians are at the West as a result of that period.
I actually just watched, there's a great documentary, if you ever get the chance to see it, called The Putin System on YouTube. It was done for, I think, Canadian television, but it's about the rise of Vladimir Putin. And one of the things that they say was really formative in his life was the fall of the Soviet Union, when he saw everything collapse. And he left the KGB when the Soviet Union collapsed because he realized it was disadvantageous to be a member of them, but he was still involved nominally.
I mean, he still had the training and and know-how.
So. All of the people who are now in his government are ex-KGB guys.
Oh.
So it's, you know, he never really broke the bond, but officially he did, and he became mayor of St. Petersburg. And they had such bad starvation in St. Petersburg that they actually had to receive food aid from Germany.
Wow. Yeah,
I mean, if you can imagine, if like that would be like if we had mass starvation in New York City and Mexico had to send up, you know, food relief to the United States. I mean, it's something that to him was the greatest disgrace, because Russia, the Russia he knew growing
up.
Well,
it sounds similar to, and I don't want to jump too much to conclusions, but it sounds similar to, you know, the post World War One that Hitler grew up in Germany watching, where he just felt like his motherland was so disgraced that he could not take it anymore, and he had to bring it back to its original glory.
Exactly, you hit it right on the head. Exactly, that's what led to the rise of Hitler, and you know, the ultra nationalism and whatnot. And that's what's led to the rise of Putin, because with the starvation, the collapsing economy, the massive unemployment, and the corruption of Yeltsin, when Putin finally came to power, well, the first thing he did is he worked with the oligarchs and Yeltsin, but as soon as he got to power, he betrayed them all, brought in the ex-KGB.
Yeah.
And one of his first acts as president was to restore the old Stalinist national anthem with new lyrics, but the new lyrics were written by the same guy, because he had a dream of restoring the empire, restoring Russia to its imperial glory, never to be shamed again, which also means, though, that the people who shamed him, just as Hitler took out his anger on the rest of Europe, Putin blames the United States for the downfall of the Soviet Union.
And anybody who's connected to it. Yeah, and similarly, I read an interesting article in The Economist about Putin's Russia. It was, 6 months ago or something like that, but it is scary how he is instituting these things, and the general public is buying it, because they're like, you know what, Glasnost and all these things, it didn't work. I mean, look at the corruption that it created, you know, because we obviously, not that they couldn't handle democracy, but it's like, you know, that's not our bag. So let's go back to what works. And you can't argue with results under communist rule. Everybody had a job, you know, like I read this book called The Tiger, which is, it's an interesting book about Amur tigers in Eastern Russia, but the area of Eastern Russia, it's called the East Primorye region, where this huge forest, it's actually called it's a geographic type of area called the taiga, which is like all coniferous trees and very thickly wooded snow, etc. And talking about this area was so crazy, because it's like, once communism left and it was a free market economy, that area, like there's no jobs. Everybody's just living off the land. Like everybody's a hunter, a fisher. They literally go out into the woods for 3 days, get as much game as they can, and that's how they live. They don't have a job. They don't have anything. They just have relics of the old communist system, which they want to go back to, because at least they had a steady source of income and the ability to feed themselves other than going out and hunting.
Well, and that's, you know,
if you just tuned in, I just want to remind listeners they're listening to In Context Monthly War Report. I'm here with the military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe, and Jeep Ward is our guest co-host.
Hey.
And that's something I think you really hit the nail on the head on, is the Russians have a view of prosperity different than Americans. You know, Americans like the idea of, well, I want to get my BMW, I want to, you know, I want to drive my Cadillac SUV, my Hummer and whatnot, and get this big house. And to Russians, and I think this is a holdover from the days of the Mongol hordes and the Teutonic invasions, the most important thing to them is subsistence and security.
Yeah.
So they will say, look, I will drive a dinky little Soviet-made car that looks like everybody else's, but I'm safe.
And that's,
I have a job, I have food.
Well, I don't have to worry about food and shelter at all times. And honestly,
exactly,
that is a much more pure definition of prosperity. Prosperity is really that you do not have to worry about your basic needs. A place to sleep, shelter,
right,
the elements, having
and
food.
When you look at places in America, you say, we're not fulfilling these needs. And if there's one thing that holds Americans together, it's economic opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And it ain't being delivered today.
No. Because there's no real profit margin in providing these things to the people in America who don't have them, because they don't have the money to buy it.
Right,
so it's like, if there's
driven.
No money there, then why would we go there?
And what you're observing also shows why I think the color revolutions that we were successful in fomenting in other countries aren't working in Russia. And you know, we're trying. We're finding
there. We've been trying. We've tried to. Well, and that's where, again, this documentary, one of the things that one of Putin's associates pointed out is, they said he will court communists, he would court liberals, he would court nationalists, because we tried to have this an ultra-nationalist revolt. We were trying to ferment it. It didn't really work because Putin said, look, I'm a nationalist. And then he goes and he says he's wearing this, he wears the same cross that he was christened in, you know, and things like that to appeal to the Orthodox community. Yeah. And then at the same time, you know, he goes to the Muslims and he says, well, see, we've established an Islamic government in Chechnya. And so he really, he's very adept at courting all parties, but also making sure all parties get the concessions that they want. So the nationalists want tighter immigration laws. So Putin says, okay, but then he doesn't want a revolt from the immigrant community. So he says, well, you can become citizens by joining the Russian army. Yeah. And then, you know, he wants to court the Orthodox Church. You know, the patriarch is his confessor. And, you know, he is very adept at making sure everybody, the communists, everybody has something that they want. Mm-hmm. And it's ultimately, I think that's what's made him the strongest leader. And he has a cult of personality.
March, if I could bring us back to Syria and the Russian-U.S. confrontation there. The Turkey has just supplied Stinger missiles, right? It just announced.
Through us.
Through us.
Turkey.
Right. I mean, they wouldn't, they're required to get our approval under, I guess, our relationship with Turkey.
Well, because we sell them
okay,
to them.
Okay, so what is the significance of Stinger missiles going to the rebels in Syria, and what can Russia do about that?
It's upping the ante. The Stinger missile is a brilliant, brilliant weapon. And when it first was invented, it frightened the Russians because it's a man-portable, handheld, surface-to-air missile system. It's relatively idiot-proof. It's point and click, basically.
Yeah.
And it has a laser tracking system. And it is very difficult for aircraft, especially low-flying helicopters, to evade them. And like I said, it's man-portable, so it's very hard to track down and destroy. So that could really even the playing field for the rebels. Now, what it's going to mean for the Russians is they're going to up the ante. Russia already has special forces. They deployed SOBR units, their elite police counterterrorism units. They've deployed Navy Spetsnaz and whatnot, and
And they have a naval fleet.
Yep, the Russian commandos, the Spetsnaz.
The Spetsnaz. Doesn't it sound like they're from like Star Trek or something?
Yeah, exactly.
These guys, they're nuts. I saw a training video they had. And like our special forces, and not to knock our special forces, are some of the best in the world, but the Russians are mental. I saw during their special forces training, they had to hold out a table with a glass of water on it. And this instructor walks down and punches each one of them in the gut. And then he gets to this one guy, and I guess he just didn't like the look of his face, runs down the hallway, comes back and does like this flying kick into the guy's abdomen, ruptured his spleen.
Jesus.
These are the kind of like, they're special forces. Like, they accept like a 20% death rate during training.
Can you imagine? 1 in 5 die during training?
Yeah,
crazy. Things must be bad to join.
It's the social status. Because one thing Russians have always prized is their military. Mm. So like in comparison to Americans, we've always looked at, you know, the rock stars. We always looked at the movie stars. To Russians, the rock stars were the soldiers. You know, to be one of the Red Berets or the Galubi Barietti, the Blue Berets, you know, was to be socially, you know, at the top.
You're a big deal, yeah.
Exactly. You could come from the poorest of the poor, but you get into the Blue Berets, the Red Berets, or the...
Instead of getting signed to a baseball team, you end up being a Blue Beret or a Red Beret.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is the pinnacle of social status, which also means, though, that, you know, like I said, severe training is almost for them it's worth it. But a big thing, though, is that these guys deploy on the ground. They don't pull their punches. Like, in many ways, when we deploy guys on the ground, we'll do kind of half-heartedly. These guys deploy on the ground.
Is this a bluff, do you think, that we're going to land special forces? I mean, if we do, it could get pretty ugly then if the Russians have special forces to fight.
This is setting up, like, right now, I personally believe that we are in August of 1914, and Syria is Serbia.
Somebody from Serbia is about to get shot.
Exactly.
Who's the Archduke?
Exactly. Well, that's the big question.
Could be Assad. They tried to murder
Assad. Who's
going to
be
right?
The Archduke? You know,
that I think is the big question. Because right now
they blew up Assad's whole entire staff. I got to believe he was one of the targets, and they missed him.
That's why one of the things I wonder is exactly that: who is going to be the Archduke, or what event is going to be like the assassination of the Archduke? Because what's happening is, I think we may deploy special forces because what we're terrified of is the Israelis attack Iran, and now we're fighting a two-front war. Right. We want to take out Assad. Let the Israelis quarrel with Lebanon.
Okay, so that's a basic military strategy. I think people have to understand the Syria deal is really about Iran. We got to take down Syria first, so we don't have them at our back.
Exactly. We don't want to fight a two-front war, especially since the Russians have a naval base there. This will give us full-spectrum dominance over the Mediterranean if we could take out Syria. The thing is, though, is the Russians aren't going to let us. So the big question becomes, we push them, they push back, we push them. The best comparison is it's like people smoking a bunch of cigarettes in a room full of gasoline.
Yeah.
And either an accidental event, you know, could spark it or an intentional one. So the question is, what is going to
be? And either way, how can you tell whether it's an accidental or
exactly.
You know. Exactly. How are we going to know? The Gulf of Tonkin?
Yeah. Well, even the assassination of the Archduke of Austro-Hungary may have been orchestrated by the British Secret Service.
Right. Yeah, I think there's some information that supports that now. Right?
You know, so, I mean, that is what we as Americans have to realize, especially, is we are standing on the precipice. And now there still is the opportunity for us to back down.
The fiduciary cliff.
The fiduciary cliff. Exactly.
But, you know, why don't we open the phones now and see if people want to participate in the conversation? You're listening to In Context, WPKN 89.5 FM, and we're doing our monthly war report. So if you'd like to call in, it's 203-336-9756. Can they do email too?
Yes, I can open up the email.
Okay, you could also email us. Some people are a little shy about being on the phone. Drop us an email at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org, and we'll read your question, your comment. The phone number again is 203-336-9756. Tell us what you think about the possibility of U.S. landing special forces in Syria, about this overall confrontation with Russia. Should we be backing down? Should we give up our imperial ambitions, or do we have no choice because we're so dependent on oil?
Well,
I feel like, unfortunately, we have no choice because, you know, oil is something that drives everything in America. You know, I mean, it's the number one thing that we consume. I know it's probably because of my commuting back and forth to New York. It's probably my base expense.
Sure. But about $4 a gallon, I'm thinking you probably burn 3 or 4 gallons each way. Say $30, $40 in gas round trip plus tolls.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So unfortunately, we have to protect those assets, you know, so we have to go in and do what we have to do to be able to make sure that Americans can continue getting cheap gas or, you know, as cheap as the oil companies feel like making.
Yeah, and that's the sad truth of it is that, I mean, imagine something I was saying earlier, too, is that if the Russians gain full spectrum dominance, and I'm not in favor of war by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a problem. If they gain full spectrum dominance over the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and South America, I mean, if they want to turn off that tap, all of a sudden, for us as a commuter nation, gas goes from $4 a gallon to $15 a gallon. Yeah. I mean, that could cause total economic collapse.
Honestly, it could also be a good thing.
Yeah.
It could be a good thing because all of a sudden, and I feel like change and progress, unfortunately, has to be preceded by a catastrophic event such as gas prices going up to $15 a gallon, where, you know, you have your, I don't want to be too generalizing, but, you know, you don't have your Humvees or your soccer mom wagons out on the streets anymore. People are trying to figure out how to take mass transit, how to be able to utilize, you know, such a thin public transit system as we have here. So hopefully maybe cities will take money, or more money would be allocated to things like, you know, light rail freight, you know, commuter trains, even regional trains, you know, update the Amtrak system, because we have the infrastructure in place. It's just been so underused that it's neglected.
Exactly.
And it would cost much less. It probably would cost much less and last much more to be able to update our rail system rather than to continue updating the roads, because the 18-wheelers are chewing them up.
That's right. That's right. But, and as I say, it takes a real kick in the pants. But I'd rather have a quadrupling of oil prices than have a lot of Americans get killed.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing worth that. You know?
Yeah. I would hope that our military leaders and our president would understand that, especially in an election year.
Yeah. But so that's the game. Do we have a caller?
We actually do. This is Rob from Bridgeport. Go ahead, Rob. You're on the air with WPKN.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, guys. Interesting point. You just brought up the election. And, of course, the Republicans always want to make it look like the world is on the edge of blowing up in order to gain votes, which always happens when the Republicans stir up things enough. But the couple of wrinkles that I'd love for you to discuss is, The Iranians know that the Israelis have had pretty much no trouble at all hacking their nuclear program. And I would think that the military, the Iranian military, has no confidence at all that the Israelis haven't hacked their missiles as well. And that there's every chance that if they fire a missile from Iran to Israel, the Israeli hackers would be able to turn it around and send it into Tehran. So I think Iran is terrified of being pushed into a corner, and not having a choice in order to maintain the sort of macho character which drives so much of politics, and especially international politics, to do something that would destroy themselves. And the other point is the likelihood in I think the only likelihood apart from all-out war, and I think it's more likely, is that the Alawis basically retreat to Latakia and the other areas on the Mediterranean coast, which are Alawi majority, and permit the Druze in the south to choose their allegiance, whether they want to be part of a small Druze nation or be part of Jordan for their protection, and basically allow the every village and citizen in current Syria to decide their allegiance, whether it's to a new Syria, a larger Syria, which would be like 90% of Syria without Latakia, etc., which is where most of the money is too, and and let the Turkmen decide to be citizens of Turkey if they want, let the Kurds decide to be citizens of Kurdistan if they want, and I think that would settle a lot of problems. Anyway, I can't talk to them on Irish, but maybe you guys could.
Well, thanks very much for those.
Thanks
those
very
questions
much, Rob.
Comments,
I really appreciate it. And actually, to address your first question with regards to Iran and the nuclear program and the virus, one of the things that hasn't been very well publicized but I think has really perturbed the Americans and the Israelis is the fact that we sent in the first virus, I believe that was the Stuxnet virus,
right,
and the Iranian computer network crashed and they went, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Well, shortly thereafter, Chinese computer experts were brought in and Russian computer experts were brought into Iran and they defeated the virus. And then every successive virus, they've been able to defeat with relative speed. And I think to the Americans, the Israelis has perturbed us a little bit. The most distressing thing for American and Israeli military strategists has been the bringing down of our drone. Now, because in the spirit of what you were saying too, especially about the ability to turn the missiles around, I think one thing we're frightened of too is the fact that they were able to hack in. They didn't actually hack the drone itself. They hacked the GPS signal, because I think I had a computer expert explain this to me once.
Now, to go back, this was a plane, a Turkish plane that was shot.
No, I'm talking about the drone, the American drone that was brought down in Iran.
The one that went down in China?
Okay.
The Chinese computer experts, it looks like, brought it down. Chinese and Russian computer experts. Because the drone, it was one of the best CIA stealth drones. And it appears that the signal was hacked going from the GPS satellite down to the drone, because it's encrypted going from the command and control point to the satellite, but not from the satellite to the drone. And they hacked into it, and they told the drone that its landing coordinates were inside Iran. So the drone plops itself down harmlessly inside Iran. And so I think that was something very distressing to the American and Israeli strategists, was the fact that they can get inside our GPS, because our entire military runs off of GPS. And if you can tell an armored division that it's a mile off in the wrong direction, you get them driving backwards. I mean, everything's run on computers. And then also on the subject of, as you mentioned, the Turkish jet that was shot down off the coast of Syria was shot down with a Russian Pantsir-1 surface-to-air missile system. And it was equipped with the latest and greatest Israeli countermeasures, the Turkish plane was. Even though it was an older F-4 Phantom, it was still equipped with the latest and greatest Israeli countermeasures. So, and this plane was brought down by a new Russian surface-to-air missile system. So a lot of that is very distressing, but a lot of that also gives Assad confidence, because the Russians have been shipping in their even larger S-400, which they've just commissioned, their S-400 surface-to-air missile systems into Syria and into Iran.
So these S-400s, what are they?
They're the latest and greatest in Russian surface-to-air missile technology. they apparently, at least from what a lot of military analysts are saying, can bring down stealth fighters, stealth bombers. They have the capability of hitting incoming ballistic missiles. Wow. They can shoot into the upper atmosphere, that kind of thing. I mean, they're huge, but they are literally the cutting edge of surface-to-air missile technology, because the Russians have been watching us since 1991 and playing catch-up. The problem is, after 91, we kind of stagnated. We said, okay, we've hit our pinnacle of military technology. Let's ride this for a while. The Russians and the Chinese saw us, and they said, ooh, these guys are a lot better than we thought. So they've been investing for the last 20-some-odd years in better military technology. Now it's coming to fruition. The T-90 tank, the S-400, the surface-to-air missile system, the Iskander ballistic missile. So the Russians and the Israelis and the Chinese and even the Syrians are in a position of relative security. And on the subject also of the breakup of Syria, one thing Assad has been brilliant to do is placate each of the different ethnic groups. Because Assad has said to the Druze, listen, you don't want to be taken over by the Wahhabis. They'll have you all killed as unbelievers. And so they go, oh, geez, I guess we got to side with Assad. And they said to the Kurds, he's like, I will give you autonomy, a little bit of autonomy, but even better, I will let your Kurdish rebels live in northern Syria so you can go and attack Turkey, because I don't like Turkey
either.
Well,
Rob pointed out, all these little groups are really important to understanding the politics of the region, but the big picture is they're all being played by us, I think, in Russia. It's like, when we go after the Kurds and we say, we'll give you this in northern Iraq, because we want to fragment Iraq and make it easy to play with, right? So, Kurds could have what you want in northern Iraq. And we play that game all over the world.
Exactly. Playing off these little parties against each other.
In fact, that was the Israeli, something called, Jeep called the Oded Inyan Plan. Uh-huh. You can read it on the internet. This guy was a top Israeli foreign policy expert, and he published this plan back in the 80s, which was supposed to represent the Israeli government thinking at the time. And he called for basically the conquest of the Middle Eastern states at Syriatum by Israel, presumably with the U.S., and breaking them up into small non-governable pieces. And the idea is that when you break them up, they're putty in your hands. You essentially can create something like the new Ottoman Empire with these little provinces, and they'll be under the hegemony of the U.S., NATO, and Israel. So, hey, by the way, if you'd like to call in and speak with us, it's 203-336-9756. You're listening to In Context, our monthly war report on WPKN 89.5 FM. My name is Ken. I'm here with Marchand and Jeep. The number again is 203-336-9756. Tell us what you think about the prospect of war with Russia, about what we should be doing in the Middle East. Should we get the heck out of there? Should we learn how to run our houses on solar energy instead of fighting over oil? Tell us what you think.
Well, and actually, we have a question on the email from M in Connecticut.
What's up, M?
M writes, is it possible that we will enter a Cold War-like stalemate? And I think that we potentially could have, but the thing was, during the Cold War, you had MAD, mutually assured destruction. We knew if we pushed the Soviets a little bit, they pushed us a little bit, the Contras and Sandinistas, the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. But we knew if we pushed each other too far, nuclear war, we could both destroy each other. We were equally matched. Yeah. The problem is now we're unequally matched. Like Austro-Hungary, was very unequally matched to go fight the Russians during World War I. We're very unevenly matched because our military stretched way too thin. We've been drained by, how long have we been at war? 11 years of war. Our military industrial complex is, it's all going to the money's going to contractors. Our military's underfunded. Yeah. Our national defense has just been left to rot since the end of the Cold War. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Chinese have both been playing catch-up. So they see themselves in a very advantageous position.
Well, one thing I want to ask, though, what you're saying is sort of is playing into something that I hope doesn't happen, which is dumping more money into the military, the DOD and things like that, where it's, you can always continue to develop better, more efficient weapon systems. And we still do at the same time. But, the money that just gets burned up in R&D is not worth it. Like, we should invest in our country, not in, trying to protect against something that is like we need to front, like, we have all this so that we can protect these interests. And that's the unfortunate thing, is it all boils down to a dollar, yen, whatever you want to call it. And how can our country run if we don't have these interests here?
Well, and you're absolutely right. I mean, in all honesty, I think the best thing, if we really wanted to improve American national security, we look towards our home defense. We stop investing in building bridges in Afghanistan, and instead we look towards, you know, building better...
If we're going to invest in another country, we should be investing in humanitarian aid, not in...
Yeah, I mean, the Peace Corps... You know,
not in military dictatorial control, you know?
I mean, if we really... If we actually want to make national security our primary concern, I mean, there's a reason why nobody invades Switzerland.
Yeah.
Switzerland doesn't expand, but the reason why nobody invades it is because it's a fortress. The population is very well armed. The military is very well funded, but the military is also not stretched all over the world.
I mean, along those lines, can you talk about the Russian recent release of information that a Russian attack submarine was sailing for weeks undetected in the Gulf of Mexico?
I heard about that too.
Yeah. It's actually, I had a friend of mine a while ago tell me this off the record, and he had been in military intelligence and all the rest of it. And one of the things that he told me that I thought was rather quite significant was that the Russians and the Chinese have subs patrolling our coast on a regular basis. And not only that, but they actually also have a naval base established in Venezuela. Now, that's all open source, too, the naval base in Venezuela and everything. You can Google that Russian base in Venezuela. And even the launching of the Russian missile off the U.S. West Coast.
The Chinese, right?
The Chinese missile off the U.S. West Coast. Which we try to play off as a chemtrail, which I thought is a little ridiculous because, I mean, you don't have to be a military analyst to look at this footage and go, that looks like a rocket. But be that as it may, one of the things that's interesting is that the Chinese and the Russians are doing this because they're prepared in the event of a war. Part of it is to send us a message that, hey, we can hit you at home anytime we want. Part of our problem is that we're burying our head in the sand going, this can't possibly be true. This can't possibly be true. This can't happen to us. And so... We're ignoring it. And I think the only reason this got reported is because that submarine got caught.
Unfortunately, we only have about 12 minutes left in our show. So if you want to get a call in, just jot down this number, 203-336-9756. And you're listening to the monthly War Report. Our series is In Context, and the name of the station is WPKN 89.5 FM.
I feel like our best possible recourse for this is change our foreign policy to let's not be jerks to everybody.
I
can agree.
Let's not just show up to every country with some guns and be like, hey, this is how it's gonna run now. You know, maybe we should just help people as opposed to just be like, you don't know what you're doing. You want democracy and you want the kind that we have, even though we don't understand your culture. We're just going to come in here and retrofit everything that we have because you obviously want a picket fence and a driveway with 2.5 kids.
Well, especially
two kids and a midget, but
especially in Afghanistan, you know, those mud huts really could do with a soccer mom there.
Yeah,
I'm just
of course.
Saying.
And a baby on board, a little stick figure family on the back of their truck, you know?
Then they'll be happy.
Then they'll totally be happy. Drop a couple flat screen TVs on a village, they're straight. They'll be like, whatever, do what you want. You know? As long as they get Snooki in there, it's all good.
Snooki, instead of the Jersey Shore, it's going to be the Kandahar Shore.
Exactly.
Which would be ironic, too, because it's a landlocked country. The Kandahar Shore, greatest oxymoron on the planet. We actually have a call. I kept him waiting for a second, but...
Thank you for your patience.
Go ahead, caller. You're on the air with WPKN.
Okay, I used to do radio, so I understand the timing.
What's your name and where are you from, please?
Jeff, I live on this planet we call Earth, and we won't blow it up too soon.
Thanks for calling, Jeff. What's on your mind?
So, you know, you guys do raise a lot of interesting sort of questions and help people realize that it's a really complicated picture out there, and it's not just one group, because on top of all of those people that work for the government, you've got the anonymous people, you got the Chinese over here, you got the Russians over there. So we're building this military to fight wars of the last century when, you know, you've got everybody and their brothers spying on everybody and their brothers' other computers. So while we're building jets, you're not fighting against the ability to, and I know you guys have talked about this, to shore up the defenses of all of the computer networks.
Well, that's actually a very valid point you make, too. Our computer infrastructure, our digital infrastructure, is incredibly vulnerable. I actually listened to a great lecture. They were talking about the threat of EMP attacks, you know, which actually makes the nuclear weapon kind of passe, if you will. You can detonate an EMP bomb, and it'll wipe out an electrical grid. And our problem is that we've never invested in hardening our electrical grid. And apparently it is incredibly cheap to do. It's like adding another coat of rubber onto the wiring and onto the electrical boxes. We just don't invest in it. And to me, that's a far greater threat than a bunch of creeps running around and exploding rental cars.
That would just take, what, one bomb from a submarine, right?
It could be launched from I read in Popular Science, it would take roughly two missiles detonated over the United States to wipe out the entire electrical grid, and they could be launched from submarines. They could even be launched from surface vessels disguised as cargo ships. I mean, it's something that would be very easy to do because we have since the end of the Cold War,
electric magnetic pulse. Is that what it is?
Exactly, the electromagnetic pulse.
It's like in Ocean's 11 when they cut the power in all of Vegas. That's right. An EMP bomb.
Exactly. It's
like a nuclear weapon, except it's the same type of destruction as a nuclear weapon would cause without all the actual people being incinerated.
Jeff, you're still with us?
Yeah, everybody would just die slowly over a period of a few days because there'd be no power to run anything. There'd be no communications. There'd be no refrigeration, and there would be no food. Which brings me to sort of the biggest, most important thing. What is the most important issue that we face as people on this planet?
Food security.
Right, and if you look at the food crop failures, first in Russia in 2010. Which followed by Australia, then in Texas twice, you had 4 wheat crops rolling around the globe. Now you lost a part of your corn crop and soy, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to find that people will have billions of dollars, and they won't really be that good to eat when there's no food and no bees. Everything else doesn't matter. So while we pour billions and billions of dollars into weapon systems, we're just all going to end up starving.
Jeff, what would you like to see the government do in terms of changing priorities, and what would you spend on in the United States?
I would like someone to stand up and speak the truth. I would like someone to say, hey, you know, this planet is failing right now. Your ship is sinking. You either bail or die, and we better either get on it or it's going to be game over. Your planet's literally melting, and our response to it is, I'm going to have another drink.
Yeah. I would like to add a caveat to that, actually. It's not that the planet is failing. It's that our species is failing to be able to live harmoniously with the planet. Planet doesn't care. If we extinct ourselves, Mother Earth don't care.
You're right.
You know? I mean, in a million years, it's going to be lush and green again. It's just not going to be uninhabitable for us. So we're... All this, like, we have to save the planet, we have to save this and that. What it really is humanity needs to make significant changes in how we work with the planet and nature to be able to save our ass. Because the planet's going to continue on no matter what.
Well, yes, except you got this one giant wrench in there that changes everything. Once the people aren't around to keep all of the nuclear facilities' spent fuel pools from vaporizing... they'll all burn, and then everything will be unbelievably radioactive everywhere.
Wow. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it with that. That rather serious thought, Jeff. Thank you so much for calling in.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. And we actually have another caller. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air with WPKN.
Could you please give us your first name and what town you're calling from?
Yeah, this is Paul from Weston.
Oh, thank you, Paul, for calling.
Yeah. First off, I wonder if you could clear up what I kind of think of as maybe an urban legend kind of thing. First of all, I've heard, said over and over again that the United States spends literally more on defense than the rest of the world combined.
I think that's right. We did look at the budget when we were discussing the campaign last show, and it's about $800 billion. Our budget, which is $3 trillion, is driven by defense, which is about $800 billion, and medical care, Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And if you throw in food stamps, that comes up to about another $800 billion. So that's where the money is, and it's probably accurate to say that. We spend more on defense than anybody else.
And in defense, too, though, we spend lavishly but not smartly. An example being the fact that if you look at Afghanistan or even Iraq when we were there, we spent a tremendous amount of money on having KBR, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton, KBR truck drivers, cooks, and whatnot, instead of having army cooks do the exact same job, and one thing KBR would do just to run up the bill is they would drive empty trucks back and forth across the country just to run up the bill. So we're spending a tremendous amount on defense, but not smartly. The Russians spend a lot on defense, so do the Chinese, but they invest it differently because all their weapons and arms industry is state-owned.
They offer extra incentives on the breadline.
Exactly.
Paul, if we were to reorder the priorities, what would you do? You think we should spend less on defense? And we take in at the federal level half of what we spend. So we got to do something. How would you rearrange the deck?
Well, based on my two freshman courses in economics, mumble to mumble years ago, I think what we need is, is spend some money. Like, for example, the M1 tank, I've read articles recently, so the Pentagon says we don't want to modernize all the tanks, we've got more than enough tanks, but Congress is saying, no, you want to buy more tanks because I've got a contractor or a subcontractor in my home district, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let those jobs disappear in an election year.
Well, and that's a huge problem, too. I mean, one of the things, I was doing research on the new Russian armored personnel carrier, I think it's the BMP-4, but one of the things that's interesting, they wanted to replace the turrets. Now, when we want to modernize our tanks, I'm afraid you're going to have to scrap the whole thing and buy all new tanks. The Russians just, you can literally screw off the turret and replace the turret. You want to add more armor, they get better armor, you unscrew the old ones,
modular,
you slap on the
construction.
New. Modular construction. A lot of our construction is exactly what you said. It's designed to create, to create more work in these districts because the congressman or senator doesn't want to be the one to have to say, we're going to have to be laying people off or, having to cut defense spending.
Yeah.
The other question I had was, in dealing with the Middle East and Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan and all the rest, I just wonder how relevant is the concept of the nation state versus the the tribe, the family, that sort of thing.
Wow, that's a great question.
All of the nations we see on the evening news in pretty colors didn't exist before 1920.
Well, and you know what? Actually, you make a very valid point. We only have about 1 minute left, but just to hit on that really quickly, in places like Afghanistan or even other parts of the Middle East, identity to your tribe, to your clan, to your family, or to your religious affiliation is far more important than the nation state. I mean, we come into a place like Iraq and say, "Oh, you're all Iraqis," and the Iraqis go, "No, I'm a Sunni, I'm a Shia, I'm an Alawite, I'm a Kurd." And in Afghanistan, it's even more exacerbated. I'm a Pashto, I'm a Tajik, I'm a Turkmen, I'm a Baluch. You're absolutely right, but we actually have to leave it there because we're out of time.
One final thought, Chief?
I would say that for these countries that they just sort of corralled a bunch of people and are like, you're now a coalition called this.
That's right. That's right.
This is what I don't understand is how it's possible that these people accept having, here's a border. This is what you're doing. And they're like, okay, I guess. Because it doesn't necessarily change their day-to-day life.
Yes.
But they all of a sudden maybe have to pay taxes to something that they never did before like that.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. But you're listening to In Context, WPKN 89.5 FM. We're on every Monday except the first Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. Please visit our website, incontextreport.com. And we're on YouTube as well with our videos. And also, please join us September 10th for our next show. We're going to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing with James Lane, director of a new film called A Noble Lie. We'll probably also talk about 9/11. That's September 10th, Monday, noon to 1 p.m. Thanks for joining us. And stay tuned for Mal Dankner, who is in the On Deck Circle, ready to come up.
Jazz and Standards or American Songbook?
Jazz and Standards.
Nice.
So let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded and Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us.